I want to start this off by saying that this is going to be a very difficult episode to listen to and cover, so listener discretion is advised. What turns someone into a terrifying cult leader? How do they incite such profound change within someone's worth and belief system that they will blindly follow them, even when it leads to their own personal demise? It's the promise of change, of divinity, of healing and immortality, the answers to secrets and the validation of faith and convincing marginalized and traumatized people that they are special. Their God sees them and acknowledges them. Most cult leaders present themselves as a prophet, a direct line of communication to the heavens. They are all-knowing, and with that gift, they can show their followers a new perspective on life, one that only the members of the cult will have access to. Hey guys, welcome back to a brand new episode of the Haunted Detective Podcast.
Woo!
Thank you. No cheers needed. No cheers needed. Thank you guys. Thank you. I'm your favorite host, Kelsey Childs, but everyone calls me the Paranormal Sherlock Holmes. Thank you. Wow. You guys are amazing. You're amazing. And with me,
your favorite skeptic, Pamela J.
Wow. Wow. I'm going to see myself out.
I think they just prefer me, dude.
It kind of sounds that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay. Fuck you. Fuck everybody. Fuck everything. Who gave you sound effects? Oh my God.
I'm abusing my power. Well, I figured I'd start this episode off on a little bit of a lighter note because it is going to be a very difficult episode. We actually have to split this topic into two parts, aka two different episodes, because there's just so much and it's so disturbing and it's a lot of information to absorb and process. And I want to give you guys more time to process it, and specifically myself, because I spent 3 days writing the script for this one, and I can confidently say that I am thoroughly disturbed and I think I need a break.
Yeah, the details of everything that happened here are, they're pretty graphic. So just a fat warning before we get into this.
Yeah, as I said, viewer discretion advised, or listener discretion. Without further ado, let's open the case file on Jim Jones and the People's Temple. The People's Temple wasn't just a religious movement. In more ways than one, it was a political statement, something that targeted marginalized communities, veterans, and people who felt lost in life, as the story typically goes with cults in general, but there was something different about Jonestown, something way more nefarious and sinister, and I'm not saying that to diminish or push aside any of the other atrocities that cults have performed or enacted, but Jonestown just feels different in a lot of ways. To fully grasp how close to 1,000 people ended up losing their lives at the hands of Jim Jones, and these people aren't only his cult members, we need to talk about who he was. But let me be clear, the story of Jonestown and the atrocities that the cult members faced, it's way more than Jim Jones. He was a monster who tortured and subjugated his followers. There aren't words strong enough to describe what these people must have been through. Their stories deserve to be told and separated from Jim. We are merely going over his past in this episode as a way to explain how all of this came to be. For part two, we're going to go deeper into the lives of the cult members after we finish the story of Jonestown. I want to give them an audience, a platform, and a voice that's separate from the man that took their lives, whether literally or figuratively.
Jonestown is one of those things that everyone has heard about from, I think, all generations. It's just one of those things that it was such a massive, dark mark on history that happened that I don't think anyone can shake it. And the more you find out about who ran Jonestown and about what happened at Jonestown, it just gets darker and darker and darker, because not only was the cult just so horrifying and the person that founded the cult was so horrifying, but there was like almost like a domino effect of things that happened because of the cult.
Yeah, it's a lot. The more I dug into it, the more information I uncovered. And it goes far beyond the cult itself. It goes all the way to government negligence, to political negligence. There's just a lot when it comes to the People's Temple and Jonestown. And one of the main things it really brings to light is government and political negligence. And I guess complacency in the court system.
Yeah, definitely.
To fully grasp how close to 1,000 people ended up losing their lives at the hands of Jim Jones, specifically some of these people were not even cult members, we need to talk about who he was. But let me be clear. The story of Jonestown and the atrocities that the cult members faced, it's way more than Jim Jones. He was a monster who tortured and subjugated his followers, and there aren't words strong enough to describe what these people must have been through. Their stories deserve to be told and separated from Jim. We are merely going over his past in this episode as a way to explain how all of this came to be. In part two, which will be episode 5 coming out next week, I'm going to go much deeper into the lives of the cult members and specifically the things that they had to deal with after the fact and before, and talk about repercussions and just give the victims of Jim Jones more of a voice than most coverings of this story do, typically. So, Jim Jones was born on May 13, 1931, in a very rural town in Indiana. His dad, James, was a veteran who served in World War I, but he was a victim of mustard gas. Because of that, the Joneses were partially living on his disability checks. But there were other caveats to this as well. Jim's dad did not know how to give him love or affection, and his mom, Lynetta, was simply not around due to how much she had to work. Jim was known as a dramatic kid. He was always looking for new ways to get attention. He would have funerals for roadkill that he found and would invite other kids to bear witness to these decadent and elaborate events that he threw. He would also bring home stray animals and beggars. Because of his eccentric behavior and attention-seeking tendencies, he was a pariah in his community. He saw himself as the underdog and has said, quote, "I was considered the trash of the neighborhood." During the Second World War, he was enamored by Hitler's ability to capture a crowd and make them follow him. Trying to find his place and to discover new manners of control, Jim joined different churches and tried to find the right practice for himself, but his involvement in their communities would never last long. The natural step from here was for him to become a preacher, but this didn't come until later. When he graduated high school, he was interested in pursuing a career in medicine. He ended up working as an orderly in the hospital. This is where he met Marceline Baldwin, who was a nursing student at the time. The two started dating, and in 1949, they got married. After this, he started working as a pastor in the Methodist Church until 1956, when he founded the People's Temple. By 1960, the temple was a part of the Disciples of Christ, and it took 4 years for him to get ordained.
I just can't get over the fact that he was enamored by Hitler.
Yeah, I kind of just breezed right over that one, didn't I?
Well, I find it weird that he thought of himself as an underdog and that he really went from the medical field to, or sorry, he went from like wanting to be a preacher to then wanting to be in the medical field. And then it was just like, also he really was fascinated by Hitler and his ability to make a crowd be able to follow him and do whatever he wanted them to do. So I'm like, oh, okay. Got some darkness brewing here.
Yeah, it's actually really, in a disturbing way, fascinating. There are more than a few serial killers and cult leaders at the time that Jim Jones was functioning who really looked up to Hitler. And a lot of them weren't, I mean, looking up to Hitler in itself is anti-Semitic, right? But they weren't anti-Semitic in theory. They just found it inspiring. It's really fucked up.
Yeah. Well, they probably loved that he was able to get so many people to think the same way that he did. And it was noticed by a lot of professors. And even when I was in college, people talked about it. Hitler was able to make a good speech, and he was able to, I mean, what he talked about was very hateful, But it was said that the way that he thought of himself as an underdog, and Hitler was like, well, he got like kicked out of art school. And so he had this.
No, he got denied.
Oh, that's right. He got denied art school.
Yeah.
Also, just for the record, Hitler's a piece of shit. Second, people really found his ability to get people to do what he wanted them to do. It was almost like envy. Like, well, I want to get people to do what I want them to do. How did he do it? And so it's really creepy that people were like, I want to do that too.
I want to control the masses. How did Hitler do it?
Yeah, it's like, what the fuck are y'all doing? Stop it.
It's just really, as much as I hate to say it, it's a piece on humanity, right? It's a study point on humanity. And honestly, I would love for you to talk about, not Hitler, but the ability to control and manipulate people on your psychology episode, which I'm sure you're already planning to do.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a whole science, guys.
And
please don't use it for bad when we talk about it. Please don't take notes in that way.
Every narcissist ever is like, oh, I've got my notebook.
They're like, Pamela J on the Haunted Detective podcast taught me how to manipulate people.
This is not our intention.
That's not my intention. I'm just fucking trying to educate you and spread awareness.
Here's the thing. As the underdog, Jim felt a strong need to fight for others who were like him. In the 40s and 50s, the Jim Crow laws were in full effect, meaning that the marginalization of the Black communities in America was horrific. That's an understatement. Interracial marriage, shared spaces between white and Black people, these were all things that were non-existent at the time. Segregation was in full swing. Jim saw this as an opportunity to strengthen his following and voice in his community and others. I really, looking back on it and all the research I've done, I really genuinely do not think that he cared. I don't think he cared about these people. I think that he cared about how helping these people would support his voice and leadership abilities. And not only that, but if he's one of the only, probably the only white man in Indiana and Indianapolis at the time, or even in America, generally speaking, fighting to end segregation, imagine how much control he's going to have. And this is going to come into play later. This is not me making assumptions. He really was able, by giving people hope, he was able to not only control the people who he was giving hope to, he was also able to control the narrative of civil rights movements and groups.
This guy was crazy. Like, this isn't even like messy. He had this so planned out.
Oh yeah.
That it's horrifying.
It took a long time for it to get messy.
Yeah.
In the 1920s, there was something called the Universal Peace Mission Movement, led by George Baker. He also went by Father Divine. This promoted multiracial congregations and equal rights. But Father Divine also believed that he was God and had divine powers. Towards the end of the 1950s, Jim went to visit him and grew inspired by his teachings. Jim was unhappy with segregation in general, but mainly in churches. He started preaching racial equality. He even started practicing this in his family. Him and his wife adopted a lot of children. They had a part Indigenous child who they named Agnes Jones, 3 children from Korea, Stephanie, Lou, and Suzanne, and they became the first white couple to adopt a Black baby in Indianapolis in 1961. They named him James Warren Jones Jr.
Interesting. So wait a minute. I feel so conflicted in this because I love, like, coming from just, if I did not know who Jim was and I did not know what atrocities he had done, seeing this from just a random point of view, I find it great that he's preaching equality. I find it great that he's adopting a lot of children. Like, you find it great. Like, you see a big positive influence. But it's so awful because he had such negative intentions. He had evil ass intentions of all of this. This was all just a game to him.
Well, another thing that made me very angry was listening to an account of their adoption of James. Basically, as it's put, Jim and his wife went to the orphanage and they had the intention of adopting a child that wasn't white. And his wife came over to him holding a baby that was black. And he said, "We want this one." And the person in charge of adoptions was like, "You don't want that child. That child's black. You don't want to adopt that child." And Jim was like, no, we really do. And they did it. And it sparked so much controversy.
That's insane.
But imagine how many children at this time were in orphanages or just, you know, in the system. They wouldn't be placed in foster care homes, which, again, not much better than orphanages, and they would never be adopted.
That's so fucking heinous. I can't even fathom that. I really can't.
Yeah, it's just, you know, there are some politicians today that want to bring the Jim Crow laws back, and this is what they want to bring back. So I just wanted a really quick side note.
Why? What the fuck? Like, going back to what I said, that's why I'm saying, like, it sucks, because you see this as, like, such a positive thing that he's doing.
It should be. It should be a positive thing.
It sucks that he did all of this just for, like, evil shit that he had planned. Could have been a nice man, and instead he turned out to be an asshat.
On top of this, they also had their own son, Stephen Gandhi, who has spoken out against his father's atrocities in a docuseries that I started watching on iTunes. So you can go purchase it there. Jim started calling them all a rainbow family. By all means, the People's Temple started off as a positive civil rights movement. Jim was in charge of the Human Rights Commission in Indianapolis, and he was the reason for the desegregation of many public amenities like movie theaters, restaurants, hospitals, even within the city's police department, while simultaneously running a free restaurant and housing for elderly and mentally ill people.
What the fuck?
I know, dude.
He was doing so many human rights things.
Jim and his family became a public enemy to the white people who supported the Jim Crow laws. He was getting death threats. His wife and young children would get spat on. Through this, possibly as a distraction from the ostracism he was facing yet again in his city, Jim began to research places that would survive if a nuclear blast happened from the Cold War. He actually put together a list. One of those places on his list was Belo Horizonte in Brazil, and he ended up moving his family there for some time. But he was soon to return to America and settle down in the Redwood Valley in Northern California. People from his hometown started noticing a change in Jim some years after his relocation to California. He dressed differently and had bodyguards with him. It was startling to one man who saw him and inquired about the change. Jim responded that he was at the top, and once you make it there, you must look the part.
Okay.
It's
Sorry, little guy. Once you're the best, you can't just not look like the best.
You have to be the best to be the best. You have to act like the best to be the best and stay the best.
Yeah, he took the dress for the job you want, not the job you have, really seriously. Dude is a psycho.
In 1965, Jim started seeing himself as a messiah.
There it is.
Yep.
There it is.
The reincarnation of people like Jesus or Buddha. His once Christian mindset soon turned to that of hatred for religion. He declared that he believed in Marxism and communism, or Marxist communism, which basically spoke to the fact that where religion began, communism ended, or religion ended where communism began. They could not coexist.
Oh, interesting.
We talked about this in season one, actually, which I'll re-record with you eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But Joseph Stalin ended up making religion illegal because he followed Marxist communism in Russia.
Oh.
And yeah, so it was a little interesting, but he basically saw Christianity as a means to an end to get to where he wanted to be in a communist way. Through his crusades, I guess you could say, he gained support from the Black Panthers and other political icons. He brought his followers to rallies, demonstrations, and other important political movements set out for change. So these organizations basically said, or saw Jim as someone who would gather all of his people, hundreds of people, and say, we are going to this rally and we're going to fight for change. And everyone would be like, yeah, Jim, we are. We're going right now. They would, at this point, and this is still very early on in the cult, before it was technically a cult, he had complete control over his people.
That's insane.
But underneath it all, behind closed doors, Jim had already laid down the foundation for his eventual disaster, the massacre at Jonestown. The people were expected to be devout followers. They were committed to him and the mission of the People's Temple. They basically all lived together. There's really no clarification on it at this point, but this meant giving Jim all of their money, cutting off their families, giving their bodies and minds over for hours of selfless, unpaid work and manual labor. And they were also expected to raise their children under Jim's influence. It was complete control.
Yeah, so he really thought of himself as a god.
Oh, yeah.
That's literally insane.
I know we'll touch upon this in episode 6, but did he think about himself as a god, or did he present himself that way because it was convenient and a way to control people, you know?
Probably a little bit of both.
One of the things that isn't talked about enough when it comes to the People's Temple is at this point in California, he was performing public healings, like faith healings. And people actually genuinely believed that he was healing their ailments and mental stuff and whatever it was going on. And I mean, you know, I'm the first to believe in paranormal stuff, but when it comes to public faith healings in a community like this, it's typically a placebo effect, you know?
Yeah. It's just a way to get people to believe in you and follow you.
If someone that you trust enough puts their hand on your head and says, by the power of God, you are healed, your brain believes you've been healed. It's trickery, but I mean, I know we're going to get more into this in episode 6, but yeah, it's just, oh man. As quoted by The Guardian, writer and researcher of Jonestown, Shiva Nepal, said that they were a religious group, quote, obsessed with sin and images of apocalyptic destruction, authoritarian in its innermost impulses, instinctively thinking in terms of the saved and the damned.
Wow. Okay. So they were essentially obsessed with the fact that Jim was going to save them from some type of horrific apocalyptic event, I'm guessing. And he was just like, everyone else who isn't in this group is just going to be damned, but we are the saved ones.
Kind of. It feels unclear to me because in one way, he believed that a nuclear apocalypse was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And these fears and beliefs became so strong and obsessive that he moved his followers to the Guyanese jungle in 1977. So basically,
the Guyanese jungle?
Yeah. He said, I have salvation, but it didn't feel like divine salvation, because this was one of the places on his list that he believed would be spared from a nuclear blast or fallout.
Yeah. I just can't get over that he moved them out to the jungle. Was it just to isolate them?
You know, it probably. Looking back on it, thinking about it, you know, reviewing all of the facts and the things that happened, and we're going to talk about something soon that will probably validate that. He called his community Jonestown. Of course, Jim Jones, Jonestown. How fucking narcissistic can you be?
Why not name it after myself?
Well, I dub thee Jonestown. Jesus
Christ.
Yeah,
no shit, you narcissistic asshole.
Like, what the hell?
Who's shocked? Not us.
I'm always shocked, dude.
I'm just disgusted. It's not shocked. I'm just like, damn, are you fucking kidding me? Like, why?
Obviously, this sort of thing goes downhill very fast, especially when the United States doesn't technically have jurisdiction over Jonestown. There were armed guards patrolling the compound to enforce Jones's laws and beliefs, which his teachings were played on repeat through a megaphone to the people as they were working. These guards were called the Red Brigade. The people were tortured for breaking his writ, and their punishment went far beyond sadistic. Other than the forced manual labor they were already subjected to, the members of the temple were beaten and given drugs to keep them subservient. On top of this, he would set out to humiliate them by forcing them to engage in public sex and floggings. While the punished members were being whipped, Jones was seen laughing at their pain.
Okay, so this guy was a fucking monster.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an understatement.
So I guess this would classify him as a sadist.
I think it goes beyond that.
Well, I mean, he's multiple things, obviously, but we're just adding sadist to the list.
Some other things to keep in consideration when talking about the atrocities that happen at Jonestown are the environmental factors of living in that jungle, which you don't think about that, right? You think about the cult, you think about the torturing and the punishments, but living there in itself was a punishment. It was described as blisteringly hot with mosquitoes and snakes and other pests. The soil from the jungle was too thin to grow anything, and well-trusted members were tasked with going to beg for food or getting the rotten discarded food from local markets. These people were they were described as his inner circle. So they weren't allowed to repeat that they were doing this, but it was the only way that the cult members would eat because they were pretty much starving.
So he would tell these people that they were a part of the inner circle and that's why they didn't tell anybody what was going on?
Well, no, they technically were. These were the people he actually trusted not to repeat it.
Oh, gotcha. But these people were still starving.
Yeah, yeah. They were eating rotten fruit.
Holy shit.
When the land was too dry, they had to create a sort of assembly line to get buckets of water to their crops so that the plants didn't die. It was grueling work.
So did anyone, I mean, the human body can only take so much. So did anyone like try to take him down or speak out to him and be like, hey, man, this is torture. You're torturing us every day.
They were not allowed to complain. He created an environment where no one trusted anyone. So he basically encouraged people, if they complained, they or had anything negative to say, let alone express concerns or feelings of wanting to leave, they would be ostracized and maybe shunned. It's unclear what this ostracization entailed, but I would assume shunning.
That's insane. So he really made them think like, you can't trust anyone else in this, but you can trust me. I am your savior.
Yeah. Yeah. There was no friendship. There was no trust.
What a sick fuck.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like you said, he knew what he was doing.
So they're living in this jungle. He's beating them. He's forcing them to do humiliating acts. And they're starving.
Mm-hmm.
But they went to go beg for food. So did the locals get freaked out?
No. The Guyanese authorities remained blissfully ignorant.
What?
But, while all of this is going on, you know, his cult members are allowed to send letters to their families, but these letters are heavily censored and monitored. So the family members who were discarded back in the United States, who weren't a part of the temple, began to get worried because of the letters they were receiving. And specifically, the parents whose kids had left for the jungle community, these worried parents had been trying to get the government to investigate because they were so concerned for their children's well-being, but it was a battle. You know, the government knew this was happening. Politicians knew this was happening. And we'll get into this later. There was really only one politician willing to help. But first, we need to talk about a little 6-year-old boy. And this part is sad and it's disturbing and it's heart-wrenching. And if you guys get triggered from child torture and just that sort of thing, maybe tune this part out, maybe skip over it. This is really going to be the rest of the episode, and then we're going to have a discussion afterwards. But yeah, I got really sad writing about this. John Victor Stone was the beginning of the end for Jonestown. Let me clarify. John Victor was 6 years old when a custody order was delivered to Jonestown and nailed on Jim's door. This was while he was away from the community one day. John's mother, Grace, had been a part of the temple in America but left in 1976, entrusting her husband, Tim, and other members with her son's care. She left because she felt unsafe at the temple, but she didn't feel the same.
She didn't bring her son.
She didn't feel like he was unsafe. And again, there are no specifications as to why this is.
Yeah.
If, you know, something happened with a specific temple member, or if, you know, something happened with Jim, which is the more likely.
We're not sure exactly why that happened the way that it did.
Yeah. But once the temple members migrated to Jonestown, Grace began a desperate fight for John Victor.
So maybe she, whatever happened, because obviously we're just making educated guesses and assumptions because we don't really know what happened that caused her to leave. But the fact that she left John makes me think that she either A, was forced to leave him. I think Grace could have been forced to leave without her son, or she felt that he wasn't in any danger because maybe she thought because he was with his father, Tim, that he would be safe. But I bet when she got back, she was like, oh shit, like maybe I really need to fight to get him back since I'm safe now and I feel comfortable fighting to get him back. So I don't know. There could have been a lot of different scenarios, but that's a really scary thing to probably go through as a mom, trying to fight to get your kid back.
Well, is that not kidnapping? Bringing a child?
It really is. Well, is it because his dad's there?
Well, that's the thing is normally for one parent, even if both parents are still together, for one parent to move a child to another country when both parents are in the picture, they have to have court approval and sign documents from the mother or father, whoever the other parent is, to be able to do that.
I bet she felt really helpless though. Because what is she? She probably doesn't have like photos of what was going on to prove that her son is in dangerous conditions.
Well, just you wait.
Oh no.
John Victor Stone was born in 1972 when both Grace and Tim were members of the temple. Remember I mentioned that Jim required all of his members to hand over all of their money and raise their children within his influence?
Yes, I do.
On February 6, 1972, Tim signed something stating that Jim was his son's real father.
What?
Yep. Just you wait. It is stated in this document that Tim had wanted Jim to impregnate his wife. There are different reasonings for this from different sources. Some state that Tim could not have kids, and others say that the pair wanted their child to be born at the seed of their Messiah or pastor. I believe both to be true.
I feel like I'm going to be sick.
It makes me wonder, did Jim have all of the parents do this for the kids that were born within the People's Temple?
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. He wanted control over every single part of their life, and that includes their children.
Yep.
This guy is so fucked.
To this day, this document has kept people questioning who John Victor's real father was.
Aww.
As I mentioned before, Grace left the temple in July of 1976, trusted other members to care for John, and that they did. So much so that they brought him and Tim to Jonestown with them that next year. In August of 1977, Grace filed a legal declaration asking for her son to be returned for her. She called Jim and the temple into question, making all of her concerns clear. I would assume that she probably accused the People's Temple of being a cult.
Yeah.
But Jim was ready for this and submitted an affidavit that claimed her to be crazy, unstable, and not fit to be a mother.
Love the narcissism, Jim. Love it.
He also stated in this document that if John was raised under Grace's influence, he would be ruined, something like that.
Oh, what about your psycho ass, buddy? What about you, Jim?
All the while, it's literally illegal for John Victor to even be there. He's 6 years old. 6 years old. How is the United States not getting involved already?
I actually have no idea. They're still in the jungle at this point.
Yeah.
Like, you have someone's six-year-old son. Like, yes, I get it that Tim signed a piece of paper saying that Jim was the actual dad. But at the end of the day, that's his actual mom. So I'm just really confused how this is even allowed. and why this is even a fight. Like, the 6-year-old has no business being in the fucking jungle with this madman.
The thing is, it's this whole situation screams political negligence. Anyways, to make matters worse, Tim left Jonestown and joined Grace in a now joint battle for their son. They would go to court hearings together, and on November 17th, 1977, Tim made a bold move and wrote a letter to Jim requesting their son to be returned. A court in California awarded custody to the Stones, and the DA finally requested help from the Guyanese authorities to enforce the swap of custody. Jim was still not budging and failed to show for 2 court hearings in Georgetown. The authorities went to Jonestown to serve the notice to Jim, but they were told that he wasn't there, so the document was nailed to a door. After getting back and finding the court's decision, his paranoia only got worse. John Victor was never successfully reunited with his parents and was one of the many victims who lost their lives.
Oh my God.
It gets worse. Gets so much worse. In September of 1977, Jeffrey Haas, who was the attorney for the Stones, traveled to Jonestown to ask the Guyanese government for help in getting John Victor home. Eventually, an arrest warrant was issued. The cult members were told to prepare for a siege, and they did just that. But the crisis never died down from there. Things just kept deteriorating. And that's where we're going to leave off for this episode, because it's just...
It's a lot to take in.
There are 2 more tragedies that happen, and it's a lot, so...
We're just letting you know absolutely everything that happened.
Yeah, I want to go into excruciating detail because through all of my research, the thing that I discovered is that when the People's Temple is talked about, it's always talked about from the narrative of Jim Jones, right? It's always talked about, oh, Jim Jones's cult, Jim Jones's town, Jim Jones's atrocity. It's never talked about from the perspective, or I guess even with empathy towards the people who suffered at his hands. And in order to cover this in a victim-centric way, we do have to break it up because, like I said in the beginning, I want to go through their individual stories and I want to play some audio recordings from victims. I, you know, want to talk about everything. And because Jim Jones is just such a small piece of this, his story needs to be separated from their story. So to tell their story, we're starting with John Victor and the Stones and all of that happening. But there's just, it's so much. It's so much.
Because I don't know about you guys, but I had never heard of John Victor. And his story, it really, at least from my side, it was never really told. And the people who suffered at the hands of Jim Jones, their stories just get swept under the rug. And no one really knows who they were, what kind of people they were. The kids are never really talked about. Like, it's always implied that there was, like, young people involved in the massive massacre that happens that Jonestown is known for. But no one really goes into the really, really, really dark details.
I really want to make a petition online to remove the pictures of the victims of Jonestown from the internet because it is just, like, I'm going to type it in right now.
There's no reason for that.
I'm typing in right now. The first picture, I bet you anything, that's going to come up are the bodies. Yeah. Like, okay, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25 pictures.
I can already hear people. They're like, well, it's a part of what happened. It's a part of the history. You seeing someone's loved one dead is not a part of history. You don't get that right. That's none of your business to see that. If the family members want to release a photo because they want, for instance, if they died by a serial killer or something of that sort, and they just want to say, like, this is what happened to my loved one, and they want to have a message behind it, that's their doing. But for people who feel like they have a right to see these people's family members dead, it's just, it boggles my mind.
Well, do you want to know how many pictures are not of dead people?
Hmm.
Or, sorry, let me rephrase that. Do you want to know how many pictures are not of the victims?
How many?
One, two, this is on the first page, right? Three, four, five, six. Do funeral pictures count?
I guess it depends. I'm assuming that it was probably done by a newspaper. So honestly, I think that would probably not be, I don't know. That's different because I don't, maybe the family members wanted the funeral pictures out, but I doubt that they would want like their loved one's just body just like laying there amongst the other ones. Like just, that's such a heinous thing to want to see. You know what I mean?
16. Just 16.
That's insane. I mean, that's similar with Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short.
Yeah.
One of the first photos that you look online is her body and what was done to her. And it's just,
oh my God. Someone made a movie in 2020 called The Jonestown Haunting. The cover depicts a pile of skulls and hands sticking out of it with crosses. And the tagline is the cult didn't survive, but the evil did. How fucking heinous. To create a horror movie based on such an atrocity.
Well, they didn't have to go through it, so they don't care. They don't see the implications of that. Like, they just see it as like, well, this will be good. People are going to want to click on this. People are going to want to see this. Like, no, it's not your...
Two and a half out of 10 stars, but
fuck you. Low ratings. That's what you get.
The description, a survivor of the Jonestown massacre returns to the site 10 years later and discovers the cult's former home has become a breeding ground for the super. Like, what the fuck?
Wait, what? Is it like a docuseries of a survivor?
It's a fictional horror movie. Director.
So they faked a survivor coming back?
Yeah.
Andrew, who thinks of this shit?
Well, apparently the writer and director, Andrew Jones, and the co-writer, Sharon Jones, I guess the Jones family, are they related?
Oh, shit. To Jim Jones?
Oh,
that's weird. That's weird. That's odd. That's just a coincidence. Jones is also a very common name. But it is just, it doesn't help the situation.
Dude, it's so disrespectful and it's so fucked up. And like, it's one thing, for instance, next season, we're going to be talking about urban legends and, you know, sometimes murders inspire urban legends. And it's one thing to make a movie on the urban legend, like the Candyman or Cropsy or the Candy Lady or, you know, whatever. But to actually directly, it's just, can we do better as a society? Can we just be more empathetic, maybe?
Just have a little bit of common sense and human decency. It goes a long way, I assure you.
Well, we're going to close the case file today on Jonestown and reopen it next week to go into depth about what exactly happened and the rest of the story. I want to play some interviews for you guys of the survivors and whatnot. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, don't forget to leave us a nice review. Follow us on Instagram, haunted.detective, and the rest of our socials, which will be linked in the bio. So without further ado, let's close it out, Pamela. It's on you today.
Well, we definitely hope that you guys enjoyed this episode, even though it was very dark and gruesome. But like Kelsey said, episodes are released every Monday at midnight. As soon as the clock strikes 12... take off your crystal glass shoes and put on some comfy slippers or work shoes, depending on when you're listening to this podcast.
Or your seatbelt.
And we will see you next time.
We love you. Bye.